Well, ladies and gentlemen, good evening. I'm delighted to welcome you here for this special evening lecture. This lecture closes out the series of summer lectures organized by the Seminars in Christian Scholarship. My name is Karen Mogg, and I am the director of the Meter Center for Calvin Studies. I'm also the co-director of a four-week seminar being held currently on campus, funded by the National Endowment for the Humanities. This is a prestigious program. The National Endowment for the Humanities only funded one-third of the total applications for grants that they receive for such seminars and institutes, and the 16 participants who are here on campus with us for a month came from a pool of over 50 applicants. So we are very, very pleased to host this seminar, and I am delighted to be co-directing it. Our seminar topic is Persecution, Toleration, Coexistence, Early Modern Responses to Religious Pluralism. So in these 4 weeks, our group is reading and discussing primary and secondary sources, looking at how different religious communities, different kinds of Protestants, Catholics, Jews, Muslims, interacted with each other in the early modern period. We're looking at the theory and the practice of religious coexistence. How does it work? How does it not work? What are the factors? What are the pressure points that might cause communities to struggle with each other? And what factors might cause them to find a way to live together? I'm truly delighted to be co-directing this four-week seminar with my friend and colleague, Dr. Amy Nelson Burnett. She is our featured speaker this evening. Dr. Burnett is professor of history at the University of Nebraska-Lincoln, where she has taught since 1989. She obtained her BA, her master's, and her PhD from the University of Wisconsin-Madison, where she was a student of Robert Kingdon. Dr. Burnett is the author of numerous articles, essays, book chapters, and several monographs and co-edited books, including her careful and engaging study of Reformation pastors in her 2006 monograph, published by Oxford University Press, titled Teaching the Reformation, Ministers and Their Message in Basel, 1529 to 1629. Amy's association with the Meter Center and Calvin College is not just one of shared scholarly interests, however. She served on the governing board of the Meter Center for a six-year term from 2004 to 2010. We are looking forward with great interest to tonight's presentation, Seven Myths About the Reformation Debate Over the Lord's Supper. Please join me in welcoming Professor Burnett.
Concord, in a sense, there is no need for toleration since there's no boundary drawn between those who hold differing views. Only after the boundary is established does the question become whether and to what extent there will be toleration. More than any other theological controversy, the disagreement over the Lord's Supper illustrates the importance of drawing boundaries for the shift from concord to toleration. It was the debate over the Lord's Supper, after all, that led to the division of the evangelical movement into two confessional churches, the Lutherans and the Reformed. Tonight, I'd like to talk about how the boundary that defined these two groups developed over the course of a generation, from the outbreak of the Eucharistic controversy in the mid-1520s up to the events of the mid-16th century. And I'll do so by describing what I like to call the myths about that debate that are embedded in most accounts of the Reformation. The standard narrative goes something like this. The inter-Protestant debate over the Lord's Supper broke out in 1525, pitting Ulrich Zwingli and Martin Luther against the question of Christ's real presence on the Lord's Supper. After the failure of the Marburg Colloquy, the Lutherans formulated their official position on the sacrament in the Augsburg Confession of 1530. The efforts of the Strasbourg reformer Martin Bucer to bring about agreement between the two sides produced the Wittenberg Concord of 1536, but this agreement had no lasting significance. Instead, after Zwingli's death, John Calvin emerged as Zwingli's spiritual heir and the natural leader of the movement that came to be known as Calvinism. I'm sure the story is familiar to you, enough so that I can't be accused of constructing a straw man only to knock it down in the course of my talk. Now let me go through it in order to highlight several of the myths, or maybe more better term for it would be misconceptions, that are embedded in it, starting with the two protagonists. Myth number one, the Eucharistic controversy was chiefly a conflict between Zwingli and Luther. There are a number of problems with this concentration on two reformers. The first concerns the origin of the debate over the Lord's Supper. Although Ulrich Zwingli is usually credited with beginning the Eucharistic controversy, in fact, the real initiator was Luther's former colleague on the Wittenberg theology faculty, Andreas Bodenstein von Karlstadt. In August of 1524, Luther and Karlstadt met in the city of Jena in Germany to discuss their differences, and after what might be called a frank exchange of views, the diplomatic euphemism for a very sharp disagreement, Luther challenged Karlstadt to attack him on attack him in public. Karlstadt took him up on this challenge and then published several pamphlets, in three of which he argued against the presence of Christ's body and blood in the bread and wine of the sacrament. Printed in the fall of 1524, these pamphlets, and not those of Zwingli, which weren't published until 6 months later, marked the real beginning of the Reformation debate over the Lord's Supper. The Eucharistic controversy would also spread far beyond the two leading reformers. I have identified at least 363 different titles in 758 imprints concerning the Lord's Supper that were printed between 1525 and 1529, with 244 of these, about 32%, in the year 1525 alone. Luther wrote 40 out of these 363 titles, or about 11% of the total. Now, that's a significant proportion, but it's still only a fraction of the whole. On the other side, Zwingli penned 22 works, or about 6% of the total. For those of you who, like me, aren't real good at mental arithmetic, that means there were 301 contributions to the controversy, about 83% of the total, that were not written by the two men who were regarded as the chief protagonists. In fact, there were at least 40 contributors defending the Lutheran position, 35 authors who advocated a sacramentarian position, more on that term in a minute, and 25 Catholic writers. Clearly, the debate involved more than just Luther and Zwingli, and indeed, given the number of Catholics, it was more than just an inter-Protestant rivalry. One might argue that even though a large number of writers contributed to the controversy, the focus on Luther and Zwingli is justified by the importance of the two reformers in shaping the theological debate. The point is well taken, but it gives a false impression. Luther's towering importance cannot be denied, but his influence in the early development of the debate was surprisingly indirect. His first contribution was a booklet published in two parts called Against the Heavenly Prophets, the first part published at the end of 1524, the next part coming out in January of 1525, before Zwingli had published any of his works on the Lord's Supper. Although this particular work generally doesn't receive much attention in comparison to Luther's later works on the Lord's Supper, Against the Heavenly Prophets is fundamental for understanding Luther's position. As the Eucharistic controversy became more heated, Luther repeatedly stated that there was no need for him to say anything more, since what he had written in Against the Heavenly Prophets had not been refuted. Many of his publications in 1525 and 1526 weren't directly relevant to the Eucharistic controversy because they were reprints of works that had been written before the controversy began. Up until 1527, Luther left the defense of what he understood as orthodoxy to others. That defense was carried out by two different groups. At the forefront were Luther's Wittenberg colleagues. Oop, I'm going the wrong direction. There we go. Johannes Bugenhagen, who is the parish pastor in Wittenberg, published 14 different works on the Lord's Supper during the second half of the 1520s. They weren't as prolific as Bugenhagen, but Luther's colleagues on the theology faculty, Philip Melanchthon and Nicholas von Amsdorff, also published contributions to the debate. The publications of these three men were important for helping to establish the authoritative position associated with the Wittenberg theology faculty. Outside of Wittenberg, Others who were familiar with Luther's ideas from his earlier publications on the Lord's Supper began to reflect those ideas in their own works during the second half of the 1520s. These include figures such as the Augsburg reformer Urbanus Regius, the Swabian reformer Johannes Brenz, and the Nuremberg reformer Andreas Osiander. Significantly, when in 1527 Luther finally decided to take up his pen and respond to all of those whom he dismissed as sacramentarians and Schwärmer, he made use of the elaborations of his own ideas that had first been expressed in the works of these others. Through this type of feedback, their contributions became important in shaping the broader Lutheran position on the Lord's Supper. One might therefore describe the position of the Lutherans in the shape of three concentric circles. The Lutherans are the largest of these circles, and they incorporate or include ideas that went beyond those of the Wittenberg theologians, with Luther's own ideas at the center of this set of circles. Luther played the normative role in the development of this broader Lutheran position, but he was not the sole contributor to it. The same normative role cannot be assigned to Ulrich Zwingli in the development of what's sometimes called Zwinglianism. Far more important theologically for the development of a Eucharistic theology that opposed the Lutherans were the Dutch humanist Cornelis Hoehn, Luther's colleague turned rival Andreas Karlstadt, and the Basel reformer Johannes Ecclampadius. To start with Hoehn, Hoehn was a Dutch lawyer who was involved with a circle of humanists who were favorably inclined to Luther in the early 1520s. He was arrested by the Inquisition sometime in early 1523, was eventually released from prison, and then died around the turn of 1524 and 25. He's really a fairly obscure figure. His chief claim to fame was a letter that he wrote that circulated in manuscript and was finally published called Most Christian Letter Discussing the Lord's Supper. Now, the Most Christian Letter combined a number of arguments against the presence of Christ's body and blood. Many of them came from late medieval heresy, and he combined these with a dualist metaphysic, a body-spirit division, external, internal, material, physical, or physical, spiritual, that was influenced very much by Erasmus of Rotterdam. Hoehn was also the first to suggest that Christ's words instituting the supper should be understood as, "This signifies my body." As I said, Hoehn's letter circulated in manuscript for 4 years before it was finally published in the summer of 1525, and its arguments would reappear in the writings of both Karlstadt and Ecclampadius. As I've already pointed out, Karlstadt was the one who initiated the controversy in the fall of 1524. He combined a rationalist critique of belief in Christ's bodily presence, at many points influenced by Hoehn and by late medieval heresy as well, with his own Erasmian-inspired interpretation of key scripture passages in order to argue that the bread and wine were only bread and wine, eaten and drunk in remembrance of Christ's suffering and death. Perhaps most famously, he asserted that when Christ said, "This is the body given to you," Christ was referring not to the bread, but to his physical body. His argument was actually grammatical. This, the antecedent of this, should be body, not bread. And I have here a picture of one of seven pamphlets that were ultimately published with regard to the Lord's Supper in this controversy. Johannes Ecclampadius was one of the most highly regarded biblical humanists in the circle around Erasmus in the early years of the Reformation. From the beginning of 1523, he became the leader of the evangelical movement in the city of Basel in Switzerland. His first contribution to the public debate over the Lord's Supper, which was published in the summer of 1525, was a lengthy treatise called On the Genuine Exposition of the Lord's Words, This is My Body, According to the Oldest Authorities. And I have here a copy of the German translation by the later Anabaptist leader Ludwig Hetzer. In this particular work, Ecclampadius pointed to the logical absurdities and abuses, as he called them, that resulted from belief in Christ's bodily presence in the elements. And he argued that Christ's words must be understood as, "This is a figure of my body." He supported this position with an impressive array of citations taken from the Greek and Latin church fathers and with arguments that he found in the Confessions of the Bohemian Brethren, which was a Hussite group that had emerged in the middle of the 15th century. He also used arguments taken from Karlstadt and Hoehn. because all three of these authors drew on these radical Hussite arguments and from Erasmus's interpretation of key scripture texts, there was considerable overlap among them. It was Ecolampadius, and not Zwingli, who was perceived as the most dangerous theological opponent by Lutherans and Catholics alike. Ecolampadius would write another 16 works on the sacrament, only five less than Zwingli himself. Now, in comparison to these arguments, or the arguments produced by these three authors, Zwingli's first contribution to the early debate over Christ's presence was really quite limited. It consisted of the argument that Christ said, "The flesh is of no use," John 6:63, and therefore his words, "This is my body," must be understood figuratively. And so he adopted Hone's suggestion that they should be understood as, "This signifies my body." Over the course of 1525 and early 1526, Zwingli's theology would develop significantly as he incorporated other arguments that he took from Hone, from Karlstadt, and from Ecolampadius, although he didn't cite any of them, and since very few modern readers have read the other three authors, they didn't recognize these quotations, therefore attributing Zwingli a certain originality that he did not have. Luther repeatedly pointed to the differences between his opponents, and he claimed that this indicated the uncertainty in their understanding of Christ's words, and therefore the error of their position. In fact, his opponents were united on several points, but their relationship to each other differed from that of the Lutherans. Instead of a series of concentric circles, like the Lutheran position, the sacramentarians understood the supper, their understanding of the supper was a conglomeration of ideas from various sources, some of them overlapping. It combined rationalist arguments found in late medieval heresy, especially the Taborites or the radical Hussites, with a subordination of material to spiritual things that was derived from Erasmus, and that led them to reject the tight linkage between the externals of word and sacrament and the internal working of the Spirit that Luther had described in Against the Heavenly Prophets. To this, you can add on the exegetical suggestions, the patristic support, the other rational arguments that were introduced by Hone, Karlstadt, Ecolampadius, Zwingli, and various others. In the early years of the controversy, this group was held together by the belief that the sacramental elements were only signs and not the true body and blood of Christ. This is what led Luther to brand them as sacramentarians, based on the medieval understanding of sacramentum as a visible sign. The Lord's Supper was a sacrament or a sign of Christ's body rather than the body and blood itself. Now, this relativizing of Zwingli's theological contribution does not mean that the Zurich reformer was unimportant to the Eucharistic controversy, but it does point to a different role. Rather than serving as chief theologian the way Luther did, Zwingli served as front man and chief propagandist. His position in Zurich, fully supported by the city council and outside of the boundaries of the empire and therefore of imperial law, gave him a secure platform from which to spread his sacramentarian views. Moreover, he had a dedicated publisher in Christoph Froschauer, the Zurich printer, who made his fortune printing and reprinting Zwingli's work. By contrast, Ecolampadius did not have a similar position in Basel during these years. Instead, he was faced with very strong Catholic opposition from within Basel's university and from its city council. And initially, he was not even allowed to publish his works on the Lord's Supper in the city of Basel. And of the three, Karlstadt had an even more precarious position. He was forced by circumstances into an apparent reconciliation with Luther in the summer of 1525. Although he later escaped Saxony and eventually ended up as a pastor and theologian in Basel, he was never able to counteract the negative reputation given to him by Luther in Against the Heavenly Prophets. Whereas Zurich has a statue of Zwingli, Basel has a statue of Ecolampadius, all Karlstadt has is a small plaque outside the church in Orlemunde, where he was a pastor, put there by the DDR, the East German government, at a time when he was seen as a symbol of the people's movement. There is no marker to the church in the church where Karlstadt was a pastor in Basel. Zwingli also served as a lightning rod for controversy in the sense that his opponents concentrated their attack on him. Ecolampadius' earlier reputation as a pious and learned scholar protected him to some extent from the kind of personal insults that were aimed at Zwingli. In contrast, Before the outbreak of the Eucharistic controversy, Zwingli was relatively little known outside of Switzerland, and his opponents felt free to attack both his character and his learning in a most virulent way. As a consequence, the position that he and Ecolampadia shared, and I want to stress this because they were very careful to make sure that their position harmonized and that they were saying the same things, but that position came to be called Zwinglian rather than Ecolampadian, to the great relief of later generations who otherwise would have had to not only pronounce it, but spell it. Because Zwingli and Ecolampadius were so careful to make sure their views harmonized, I think their position should be called Swiss. And after the deaths of both Zwingli and Ecolampadius, it came to be identified specifically with the city of Zurich and its theologians, just as you have a Wittenberg theology developing in the university there around Luther. And as I will discuss in a minute, it gradually became clear that the Swiss position differed in some aspects from that held by, for instance, Martin Bucer and Wolfgang Capito in the city of Strasbourg, or from Kaspar Schwenkfeld and Valentin Krautwald in Silesia, or from Konrad Grebel, Balthasar Hubmaier, Hans Denk, a whole variety of others who are lumped under the name of Anabaptist spiritualist or generally radical. Now, as you may have already realized, without a single center, it was much harder to define a common position within this very broad group that I've called sacramentarian. In fact, although there was an area of overlap and mutual influence between these factions, by 1528 there was also beginning to be a sorting out of positions around several cores. And since the Swiss and the Strasbourgers vigorously rejected the term sacramentarian, that label came to be applied especially to the radicals who were most directly influenced by Karlstadt. In other words, the label becomes more specific and begins to have a more positive content, shall we say, than simply rejection of the Lutheran position. Now, I've spent a good deal of time talking about the first myth because it is central to the broader understanding of the problem of drawing boundaries and so fixing the line between concord and toleration. I promise I'll be much briefer in my discussion of the remaining six myths. The second of these concerns the relative status of the two sides of the debate. Myth number two is that the Eucharistic controversy was a struggle between two equally balanced parties. The success of the Reformed tradition in the later 16th century has led later generations to assume that the progenitors of the Reformed churches stood on equal footing with their Lutheran opponents. When one looks at the historical circumstances, though, it is clear that the sacramentarians were a small minority struggling against a firmly entrenched belief in Christ's corporeal presence in the elements. While theologians might debate the theological arguments of both sides on equal basis, historians must acknowledge that the sacramentarians suffered from some serious disadvantages. To begin with, compared with the Lutherans, the sacramentarians had a very difficult time making their ideas known. Figure 2 gives a somewhat different view of the data I mentioned earlier, this time highlighting the number of imprints, not just the number of titles, but the total number of works, in other words, including the size of the print runs, by each party. Because Luther's works were reprinted so often, the number of imprints attributed to Luther rises to over 20%. Taken together with the works of his supporters, the Lutherans, as a total, comprise about 56% of all publications on the Lord's Supper. The sacramentarians published only about half that amount. They simply could not spread their views as easily as the Lutherans. Increasing this difficulty is the fact that in many places, such as the imperial city of Nuremberg or in electoral Saxony, their works were prohibited. Censorship did not stop the spread of the ideas, but it did certainly slow them down. Secondly, although I've said there were almost as many sacramentarian authors as there were Lutheran ones, there was an important qualitative difference in the status of the writers for each group. The sacramentarians had no one to rival Luther. As the first to oppose the Roman Church successfully, Luther had a standing in the evangelical movement that set him above everyone else. The best these sacramentarians had, the closest they could come to this, was actually Ecolampadius and not Zwingli. To make matters worse, some of those who defended the sacramentarian position lost their credibility through their association with radicals at the time of the Peasants' War. This was the case with both Karlstadt and Balthasar Hubmaier. In comparison to the Lutherans, the sacramentarians had very few university-trained theologians to defend their position. And a large number of their pamphlets were written by laymen with no theological training whatsoever. A significant proportion were published either anonymously or pseudonymously, reflecting the fact that it was dangerous to associate one's name in print with rejection of Christ's corporeal presence in the sacrament. And this brings me to the most important disadvantage faced by the sacramentarians. They were defending a position that had long been condemned as heretical. Their rationalist critique of Christ's bodily presence may make perfect sense to modern readers long accustomed to this position, but a reading of the pamphlets involved shows just how much it horrified their contemporaries. Luther and his followers agreed with the Catholics that Christ's body and blood were present, and they argued only that one could not make a dogma out of one particular way of understanding how that presence occurred. Like the Catholics, they firmly believed that Christ's corporeal presence in the elements had been taught since the days of the early church. For this reason, the proportion of Catholic publications that I have here on the sacrament is important. Some of the Catholics defended positions rejected by both Lutherans and sacramentarians, such as the sacrifice of the Mass or the distribution of communion in only one kind. But other works were specifically directed against the sacramentarian understanding of the Lord's Supper. There was surprisingly little Catholic polemic against the Lutheran rejection of transubstantiation compared to the Catholic attacks on the sacramentarian rejection of Christ's corporeal presence, period. Now, careful listeners may have noticed by now that in my discussion of the Eucharistic controversy, I have gone to great lengths to avoid the usual terminology. And that brings me to myth three. The debate concerned the real presence of Christ in the sacrament. Real presence is not a term that was used in the 1520s. As far as I've been able to trace it, it entered scholarly discussions of the Eucharistic controversy sometime in the mid-19th century through E.B. Pusey, who was one of the early leaders of the Oxford movement in England, and from there it was picked up by German church historians in their discussion of Luther. The term real, though, is not very useful when you're trying to talk about the Eucharistic controversy because it is ambiguous. It can mean either epistemologically true as opposed to false. It is the real presence. It is a true presence. But it can also mean ontologically present as opposed to absence. In other words, a substantial presence. The reformers recognized this ambiguity, and so they avoided the term. According to Joseph Telenda, it occurs only three times in all of Calvin's discussions of the Lord's Supper. Instead, if you look at the discussions of the 1520s, the reformers were far more likely to talk about Christ's bodily or corporeal presence, leiblich or corporaliter. This terminology is important because the issues debated in the Eucharistic controversy changed over time, and the phrase real presence obscures the nature of those changes. Between 1524 and about 1528, the chief question of the issue, or the chief question at issue, was whether Christ's body and blood were corporeally present in the consecrated bread and wine, a question that could be answered only yes or no, and the response to the question determined which side of the debate one belonged to, Lutheran or sacramentarian. It therefore established the boundary between these two parties. Gradually, though, the argument began to shift from whether Christ's body was present in the elements to how Christ himself might be present, and in what way. That meant introducing new terms to describe the manner of that presence, not only bodily, but also spiritually, substantially, naturally, truly, sacramentally, or virtually, to give only a few of the adverbs that get used to try to explain this type of presence. Participants also began to debate the location of that presence. Was it in and under the elements, as Luther said, or was it only with them? Or was it not in the elements at all, but instead in the sacramental action in general, or perhaps was it in the mind of the faithful? Suddenly, the number of possible responses changes from yes or no to points on a spectrum, And I have here a sort of example with ellipses to show you can have Zwingli, you can have, actually, you could have Karlstadt over here, you could have Schwenkfeld, you could have Melanchthon, Bullinger, Zwingli, Ecolampadius, a whole spectrum across the top. And the positions can also go down depending on what issue, how is Christ present, where is he present, what is the purpose of the supper, and so on. And you end up with a matrix in which individual theologians are placed depending on their particular understanding of the Lord's Supper. And now we come to the issue I raised at the beginning of this talk. Where do you draw the line that distinguishes between concord and toleration? It was this change in the question asked that made the concord discussions of the early 1530s possible, as participants tried to devise a formulation of their position that was acceptable to as many people as possible. This mention of the negotiations of the 1530s leads me then to myth four. The Wittenberg Concord of 1536 was a failure, and Martin Bucer's efforts to unite the two parties were ultimately a waste of time and effort. Before discussing the Wittenberg Concord, let me make an observation that reinforces my discussion of myth one, the roles of Luther and Zwingli. Through the decade of the 1530s, the most important contributions to the development of the Protestant views of the Lord's Supper did not come from Zwingli, who died in 1531, nor did they come from Luther, who stated in his 1528 confession concerning Christ's Supper that this was his final word on the subject. Instead, the leading figures in the debate were Philip Melanchthon, Martin Bucer, and Heinrich Bullinger, who is Zwingli's successor in Zurich. They represent various positions in the matrix between the two stakes driven at the ends by Luther and Zwingli. Melanchthon's understanding of the supper differed in some respect from Luther's, which would contribute to the bitter divisions among the Lutherans in the third quarter of the 16th century. But Melanchthon was also a faithful representative of the Wittenberg theology, the Wittenberg position within this broader definition of Lutheranism. Similarly, Bullinger represented the transition from the theology of Zwingli, or if you will, the Swiss theology, to a more general Zurich theology. As a party to Concord negotiations, he was in a more difficult position than Melanchthon. He was young and relatively inexperienced when he was chosen to lead the Zurich church, and he had to walk a very fine line between his own understanding of the sacrament, which was not the same exactly as Zwingli's, although it was very much influenced by it, and upholding the reputation of his predecessor against charges of heresy and worse that were leveled at him by Luther. Bucer had the greatest room for flexibility on the sacrament, since he was tied to neither Luther nor Zwingli. His flexibility would be condemned as inconstancy, opportunism, or even duplicity by both contemporaries and by later church historians. It would be more fair, though, to say that it reflected his genuine commitment to the unity of the church, as well as to a remarkably broad understanding of Christian truth in comparison to his contemporaries. In order to appreciate the significance of the Wittenberg Concord, we must be quite precise about what it was and what it was not. The Concord was the result of several days of negotiation between the Wittenberg theologians and a delegation of South Germans led by the Strasbourg reformers. Strictly speaking, it was neither a consensus nor was it a compromise document. Instead, it was a statement by the South Germans concerning what they believed about the supper, which the Wittenberg theologians recognized as the basis for Eucharistic fellowship. To put it in another way, the Wittenbergers expanded the boundaries of Lutheranism, in its broad sense, to include what the South Germans taught, even if that did not coincide exactly with their own interpretation of the supper. This agreement was made possible by terminological ambiguity and by strategic silence. To begin with, rather than insisting that Christ's body and blood were in and under the elements, as Luther did, a looser connection was made possible by the use of the term with. With the bread and wine, the body and blood of Christ are truly and essentially present, distributed, and received. Second, the Concord used Luther's phrase, sacramental union. It is through sacramental union that the bread is the body of Christ. And that term was ambiguous enough to allow a figurative rather than a literal understanding of this is my body. And even Luther had to acknowledge that there was, after all, a figurative understanding of this is my body. The figure happens to be synecdoche, which means that the body is there as well as the bread. Thirdly, the Concord allowed that the unworthy, or the indigni, to use the Latin term, received Christ's body and blood. This allowed the South Germans to maintain a distinction between the unworthy and the godless, or the impious, impii, who were incapable of receiving Christ's body and blood. Luther and his colleagues did not make that distinction. As far as they were concerned, the indigni were the impii. And so they could argue that everyone, regardless of their status, received the body and blood. Finally, the Concord was completely silent on the location of Christ's body, which was a bone of contention between the Wittenbergers and the Swiss. Because of these ambiguities and silences, the Concord cannot be called Lutheran in the sense of what Luther himself believed. It is instead the broadest that Lutheran in its more general sense ever became, for it accepted positions that would later be rejected by many who considered themselves Lutheran. Bullinger and the Zurich Church held to Zwingli's legacy and reputation, and they refused to endorse the Wittenberg Concord on the grounds that its ambiguity obscured the truth. By so doing, they only confirmed Luther's conviction that their church was heretical, and they put themselves outside of what was now the broad evangelical consensus, or concord, if you will, enabled by the Wittenberg Concord. But they and their closest allies in eastern Switzerland were the minority party. The cities of South Germany accepted the Concord, which allowed them to join the Schmalkaldic League, the defensive alliance against possible attacks by the emperor. Moreover, Bucer's influence extended into Switzerland itself. The Church of Basel endorsed the Wittenberg Concord in 1536, and its leaders did what they could to support Bucer's Concord efforts, especially in Bern. That city's church was divided between a pro-Zurich and a pro-Bucerin party, and by the end of the 1530s, the latter had gained the upper hand. Last but not least, John Calvin's return to Geneva in 1541 furthered that city's theological alliance with Strasbourg. So what you see is, as Bucer's theological influence extends from way up north in Strasbourg through Basel in the northwest corner, this huge territory of Bern, over to Vaud, down to Geneva, a large chunk of western Switzerland is now under Bucer's influence and supporting a policy of concord with the Lutherans. In contrast, the Zurich Church and its few allies in eastern Switzerland found themselves theologically isolated. Before I say anything more about Switzerland, though, let me go back to the Holy Roman Empire. One of the chief factors contributing to the endorsement of the Wittenberg Concord by the cities of South Germany was the fact that it could be used to interpret the Augsburg Confession. And with this observation, I come to myth 5. The Wittenberg Confession of 1530 defined Lutheranism. In one sense, of course, this statement is true, but with regard to the Eucharistic controversy, it is problematic. The fact is, there were several Augsburg confessions, each with a different wording for Article 10 on the Lord's Supper. As a quick glance shows, the Latin version presented to the emperor does not say the same thing as the German text read aloud to the princes, then the bishops and the city representatives gathered in Augsburg in 1530. Over the next several years, Melanchthon continued to revise the wording of the confession, and his most significant revision concerning the Lord's Supper occurred at the time of the religious colloquies with the Catholics at the beginning of the 1540s. They were made so that the Augsburg Confession would more faithfully reflect the contents of the Wittenberg Concord. This version of the Augsburg Confession would become known as the Variata, in contrast to the text first published in 1531, the Invariata. Now, if you look at it, the Latin text says Christ's body and blood are truly present and distributed. The German text is a little bit more towards Luther. The true body and blood are truly present, distributed, and received. So stronger in a direction away from the South German or the Wittenberg Concord. And the Variata replaces any kind of statement about how the body and blood are associated with the bread and wine by saying they are with the bread and wine are exhibited the body and blood of Christ. Exhibit is actually a tricky word. Exhibere in Latin means presented, not exhibited. It's a false cognate. But it is a word that Bucer liked to use and that was accepted by the Germans, not by the Swiss, specifically by Heinrich Bullinger. So what we have here are three different statements of the Lord's Supper. Will the real Augsburg Confession please stand up? The differences between these versions went largely unnoticed during the 1540s. They weren't all that important. but they would become significant after 1555 when the Religious Peace of Augsburg granted toleration to the churches of the Augsburg Confession. Which confession? The question that is what the question became. More to the point for my discussion, John Calvin accepted the Augsburg Confession as understood according to the Wittenberg Concord while he served as teacher and pastor of the Refugee Church in Strasbourg between 1538 and 1541. So, as I like to ask my students, does that make Calvin a Lutheran? That actually would be debated in the 1550s, but that takes me beyond the time period of my talk, and so let me move on to myth six. Calvin was Zwingli's spiritual heir and the natural ally of Bullinger and the Zwinglians. Older works that emphasize the cordial relations between Calvin and Bullinger are very much a case of interpreting the early sources, and especially their correspondence, on the basis of later developments. In fact, relations between the two reformers through most of the 1540s were rather cool, largely because of Calvin's close association with Bucer, both personally and theologically. In the wake of the Wittenberg Concord, Bullinger turned against Bucer. He accused him of abandoning the truth and misleading both Luther and the Swiss as to the true understanding of the sacrament with regard to what the other party believed. His hostility toward the Strasbourg reformer increased through the 1540s as a result of continuing factional struggles within the Bern Church. Bullinger regarded Bucer's influence on Bern as responsible for destroying the peace of that church, and some of his dislike for Bucer washed over onto the young Genevan reformer, who had worked closely with Bucer during his 3 years in Strasbourg. For his part, Calvin didn't think all that much of Zwingli's early writings on the Lord's Supper, which he dismissed as profane in a letter to Pierre Viret in 1542. Thus, the possibility of close cooperation between Geneva and Zurich did not look all that promising through the first half of the 1540s. But there were factors that could move the two reformers closer together if circumstances were to change. For one thing, Bullinger kept his relations with Calvin open, never slamming the door against cooperation as he had done with Bucer. Another factor is the instability inherent in any theological consensus that is based on ambiguity rather than on agreement, as the Wittenberg Concord was. What finally pushed the churches of Zurich and Geneva closer together was the emperor's defeat of the Schmalkaldic League in 1547, with its dire consequences for the cities of South Germany. Bucer was exiled from Strasbourg, and with his departure for England, the loose coalition of churches that stretched out along the western edge of the Swiss Confederation fell apart. A pro-Zurich party replaced the Bucerian faction that had dominated Bern's church, and suddenly it became much more important for Geneva's church to be on good terms not only with the pro-Zurich faction in Bern, but also with Zurich itself. And this leads me to my last point, myth seven. It's not really a myth. Instead, it's the fact that most accounts of the Eucharistic controversy end with either the Marburg Colloquy or the Wittenberg Concord and say little or nothing about the content and significance of the Consensus Tigurinus, which was the agreement signed between Bullinger and Calvin in May of 1549. The consensus came at the end of a long series of letters between the reformers, exchanged over the course of 2 years, in which each responded to the other's position concerning the Lord's Supper. In the final accord, both men abandoned the earlier terminology and phrasing to which the other had objected in order to come up with a text that both could accept. With the Consensus Tigurinus, the goal of theological discussion shifted from concord, or including as many views as possible, to consensus, or agreement on a central core that excluded variant views. Discussions of the Consensus Tigurinus have sometimes been framed around the question of who won. Did it more fully reflect the views of Calvin or of Bullinger? I think it's more useful, though, to look at the consensus as a mutual agreement that did not fully express the position of either man, in other words, the joint overlapping of these two circles, which was actually quite large. It contained a core that they could both accept and so established a common position on the Lord's Supper that was normative for both sides. It is this common core that signals the merging of the positions of the Zurichers and of the Genevans on the Lord's Supper, and so the birth of the Reformed Church. And if there was a loser, it was Martin Bucer, for the consensus quite deliberately avoided the language that Bucer used to describe the supper and rejected his use of ambiguity, enabling a breadth of positions in order to preserve the unity of the church. The consensus Tigurinus thus played a decisive role in the division of Protestantism into two sharply defined confessional churches, rather than allowing a single, more inclusive Protestant church based on a commitment to concord. With the consensus, the isolation of the Zurich church ended because it now became allied with a form of Protestantism that was rapidly expanding outside of German-speaking Europe and that would soon strongly influence religious developments in France, the Netherlands, Great Britain, and much of Eastern Europe. In historical terms, by allying the churches of Zurich and Geneva, the consensus Tigurinus created the critical mass that enabled the Reformed Church not only to survive, but also to flourish. And it ended any possibility of Calvin's being identified with that broad definition of Lutheran created by the Wittenberg Concord, although it would take a renewed outbreak of polemic over the Lord's Supper, the so-called Second Eucharistic Controversy, to make that clear. Concord or toleration? Choosing between the two responses requires first that we know where to draw the line between a dominant group and its dissenters. Perhaps the biggest myth I've challenged tonight is the belief that the division of Protestantism into two parties was both instantaneous and inevitable once disagreement broke out in the mid-1520s. Instead, it took roughly a generation for some of Luther's sacramentarian opponents to coalesce into what is now known as the Reformed tradition. Once the Reform had established their normative statement with the consensus Tigurinus, it would take the Lutherans another generation to agree on the boundary defining their own position, culminating in the Formula Consensus of 1577. But that's the topic of another lecture. I've spoken long enough tonight, and I hope I've clarified and perhaps complicated your understanding of the Reformation debate over the Lord's Supper. Thank you for your attention.
Amy, thank you so much for that really quite amazingly detailed lecture. I think we all know much more than we did before we came in. So what we're going to do now is have a time of questions. So if anyone has questions you would like to ask, please do ask them, and I'll repeat them so everyone hears them. Yes, Steve.
It became the Augsburg. It became the top two were finally accepted. But you have to realize that there was these were, first off, they were copied in manuscript, and not all of the manuscripts were the same. And when the manuscripts were, they weren't printed until 1531, and so the German edition printed in 1531 varied from the manuscript version in 1530. To make it simple, I used actually the version that is in the Formula Consensus or the Book of Concord, because the Latin was. And the Latin was the one that was presented to the emperor because he couldn't read German.
Other questions? Yes, George.
Could you outline the content of the consensus Tigurinus?
So could he outline the content?
In 21 articles, it's 21 articles. The main thing that is relevant for comparison with the other things is that in the course of the discussion, Calvin was forced to give up the term exhibera, to present. They rejected the use of the term instrumentum, that the elements were, or the sacrament was an instrument. Instead, the word that gets used, simile, is it?
Organum.
Yeah, that they would not go along with, basically it's the preference between Bullinger's preference and Bucer's preference. What really capped it, as far as the Lutherans were concerned, was the last few articles, which said that Christ's body was as far removed from the elements as heavens are from the earth. Mm-hmm. And that was the one that, more than anything else, made it clear mm-hmm. that this could not be accepted by any Lutheran because of Luther's own understanding of the ubiquity of Christ's body. Mm-hmm. So that's what I would say makes it a document that puts a nail in, that ends any hope of consensus, because it explicitly adopts a position that could not be accepted by the other side.
Other questions? Yes, at the back. Go ahead. So the question has to do with the change from 1525 to 28, and I'll let you...
Okay. First off, the change really begins in 1528. Through 1525, up into 1528, it's yes or no. And it's in any kind of... there's polemical debate. Sometimes what happens is the Reformed would publish a treatise, and then there would be an attack on it, and then there would be a response to it. So it starts out as treatise and then turns into more polemical. Interestingly enough, there are very few catechisms. There are Lutheran catechetical material, very little Reformed catechetical material. I'm trying to think, at this point there weren't any dialogues yet. Sermons were another way of expressing ideas. What happens in 1528 is that Luther publishes his Confession Concerning Christ's Supper, and in it he poses this idea of sacramental union. Martin Bucer in Strasbourg picks up on it and runs with it and says, look, he's actually, as he reads Luther's confession, he comes to the conclusion that Luther was, that he'd been misinterpreting Luther, and that actually there was more common ground between them. And so it's very much Bucer, especially in he writes a dialogue called the Agreement Between Luther and Zwingli or something, Vergleichung, and what I always call it. It's called Vergleichung, and I can't remember the whole long name because it's really long. But he starts to argue that, in fact, there is more commonality, and this is where you get the beginning of the argument that they really aren't agreeing in substance. That if you look at substance, they agree. It's the terminology. It's all been an argument of words. I think he was a little overly optimistic about that. But what Bucer began, and this is where the difference between the Strasbourg theology and the Zurich theology is important, because where Zwingli and Ecolampadius from the very beginning had been very careful to try to eliminate any kind of conjunction between Christ and the physical elements, the Strasbourgers had been reflecting more a kind of late medieval stream of devotion that concerns spiritual communion, where you eat Christ's body and blood spiritually as you are, for instance, watching the priest celebrate Mass. So there is an association of Christ's genuine presence in the Mass, but not necessarily in the elements in the way that the Catholic Church did. And that's actually a view of the supper that is very widespread and in some part accounts for the difference between what I would see as what becomes the Strasbourg or the South German understanding of the Lord's Supper and Zwingli and Ecolampadius. Now, the problem with Zwingli and Ecolampadius is they both die in 1531, and so they don't go any further. Zwingli kind of checked out on the discussions with Bucer. He was pretty disgusted with the whole thing, and he backed out in February of 1531, said, I don't want to continue this, and then was killed, 9 months later. And at that point, Pullinger is in a really hard position because he's got to defend Zwingli. But who knows what Zwingli would have done if he could have lived a little bit longer. Same thing with Ecolampadius.
Other questions? Yes, Denny. All right, so the question is how to explain the division between Lutherans and undergrads and Lutherans and Reformed to undergrads.
You have an hour? Basically, I try to tell them that this is actually one of my problems. I find it very hard to talk about the divisions between them. Well, I would say you can't talk about Reform before 1549. I think it's really hard. You have to talk about the Swiss or you have to talk about the Strasbourgers or the radicals, these different views. With 1549, you finally have a position that you can call reformed, so that's set. But Lutheran becomes hard, because there really is no definition of Lutheran, even though people think they know what Lutheran is, and we certainly know what Luther was. But you get all sorts of, you get someone like Paul Eber, who was a theologian at Wittenberg, who is condemned by the Lutherans for not being Lutheran enough and condemned by Bullinger for being too Lutheran. Mm-hmm. You know, he kind of falls between the school or between the camps, and in part it comes down to these three shibboleths. So the eating of the unworthy or of the impious, the actual eating, mandicatio impiorum, mandicatio oralis, oral eating of Christ's body, and the location of Christ's body, the ubiquity. And what you do, these become the divisions between the Lutherans and the Reformed, but there are Lutherans who will accept two of them and not the third. You know, so this is what the Lutherans fight about between basically 1550 and 1577.
Yes, go ahead.
Why did this issue become so important to these people?
Because the Mass itself was so important in the late medieval church. If you look at late medieval piety, one of the things that comes out again and again in preaching is devotion to the host, to the consecrated host, veneration shown to the host, the sort of protective magical power that the host has to be carried around a city in processions, for instance, on holidays, on feast days. And the Reformers, especially those influenced by Erasmus, react very strongly to this because they are saying that this is idolatry, especially if Christ is not in the consecrated host. You are worshiping a created being, a created thing, rather than God himself. And so it becomes a very controversial issue. And the other thing is, if you look at what people were taught, they were required to commune, to confess and receive communion once a year by the church. That was one of the things that made them a good Christian. What were they taught when they confessed? You have to believe this is Christ's body and blood. And so when Hone comes up and says, well, it doesn't say in the Apostles' Creed that we have to believe that it's Christ's body and blood, it raises questions about what the church has been teaching and on what, if you want to put it this way, on what authority are they saying you have to believe that Christ's body is present in the bread and wine in the very way that it hung on the cross or laid in the cradle? People reacted in a very visceral way to that.
All right. Yes, Barbara.
No, they aren't engaging in debate because they've got their position. I mean, this is one of the big differences that I see between the Catholics and even the Lutherans and the Sacramentarians. The Catholics pretty much know what they want to say, at least as far as the presence of Christ's body and blood. They actually have more problems with defending the sacrifice of the Mass because that's not something that had been discussed in scholastic traditions. So there's some variation among Catholic theologians as they defend the sacrifice of the Mass. Luther has the advantage that he can draw on Catholic arguments for Christ's presence even if he doesn't accept literally the conversion of the substance. So he's got more material he can draw on, and the Sacramentarians are left having to basically start from, not exactly from scratch, because they are getting an amazing amount of stuff from the Hussites and some from the Waldensians, but they have to put it together in a coherent form in a way that the other two groups really don't have to. So they're kind of, they have to play catch-up before they can formulate something that is as consistent and as coherent as I think the other two sides do.
All right, Lyle.
Mm-hmm. How much does the doctrine of baptism get woven into this larger narrative that you developed tonight?
That is a really good point. Baptism is, it's not, I haven't charted it in the debates, so I haven't gone through and kept track of where it occurs in published works. And there aren't as many pamphlets on baptism, but it is an issue, and especially with regard to these sacramentarians, because, of course, what's the difference between Konrad Grebel and Ulrich Zwingli? They're actually very, very close, and where they end up splitting is ecclesiology, but all of the radicals end up with their own views on the supper and baptism as well. So it's something that I think that needs to be looked at together with the debate over the Lord's Supper. On the other side, Luther's position, it's sometimes been said, and I tend to find this in, excuse me, especially in writing by Reformed theologians, that Luther didn't have a consistent understanding of the sacraments as compared to Calvin. Well, I don't think that's true. He said his understanding of the sacraments is there and against the heavenly prophets. It is the physical, the external thing through which God works, both baptism and the Eucharist. And in fact, against the heavenly prophets is as much a defense of baptism as it is of the Lord's Supper. He just doesn't spend as much time going into arguments concerning baptism. He's talking more about the external ceremony, the external means of the sacrament that God uses.
All right. At this point in time, I think we're going to draw it to a close. But any questions people have remaining, they can come up and ask. But please join me now in thanking Professor Burnett for her presentation.